the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning we speak with Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener and Professor Christian Van Nieuwenberg about their new book, Radical Listening. It dissects modern barriers to fully engaged listening and offers strategies for how we can develop the type of listening skills that lead to more fulfilling conversations and deeper connections. Then we'll talk with Park City locals Griffin Briley, Josh Itoy, and Sam Kirshner. They are all young Skimo racers. They will talk about this exciting, grueling sport that combines skiing with mountaineering and racing. We'll hear about their recent experiences at the Skimo World Championships in Switzerland and also get an update on Skimo's debut in the 2026 Winter Olympics in Italy. We'll be right back after these words. Stay with us. It's The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziers.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
In this distracted age, we've all found ourselves in conversations where someone's not listening and possibly even been the one who's drifting off. But being present is not only a gift, it's a skill and a practice. In their new book, Radical Listening, The Art of True Connection, today's guests, Professor Christian Van Nieuwenberg and Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, offer insights into what keeps us from listening with full engagement and the six core skills of radical listening that might foster much deeper connection, openness, and understanding. Professor Van Nieuwenberg and Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Thanks, Lynn.
Well, what constitutes good listening?
For me, good listening is showing that you're genuinely interested in someone. And, you know, good listening for me, the way you can tell you've listened well to someone is that you can see them thinking better, you can see them lighting up. You can, what we're hoping for with good listening is that the other person feels heard and valued, perhaps. So for me, those are some of the key things about good listening. And the point with our book is that it goes beyond simply listening to understand something or listening simply for the purposes of responding. We argue that you can actually use the skill of listening that we, most of us, have in order to connect with other people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think in this age, we are very distracted. What do you consider the barriers to good listening?
Oh, there are so many barriers. And these will sound familiar to you, but sometimes we just think we know what the person's already going to say. This is mind reading. Like, oh, but let me just cut you off right there and jump in because I'm ready to respond. Sometimes we don't feel like we have enough time. We call this time poverty. You get this with the walk with me phenomenon. Like, okay, I'm willing to listen to you, but I've got an appointment in 5 minutes. So walk with me. Like, tell me as we go. I'm in a hurry. And that's a demonstration that I'm already on to the next thing and not fully present with you. We sometimes compare, you know, you might tell me, oh, I took an amazing trip to Florida last summer. And I say, oh, I went to Florida last summer too. And that sounds like I'm trying to connect with you, but it also runs the risk of pulling attention away from you and making it about me. And then one more is the opposite of comparing, which is contrasting. So you might say, oh, I slept so poorly last night. I got 6 hours of sleep only. And I say, oh, tell me about it. I only got 3 hours of sleep. And it's sort of this one-upsmanship. But these are all really common things. They go far beyond, do you have a mobile phone out that's distracting you or a child that's distracting you? These are just sort of psychological processes that distract you.
Yeah. It's funny, as you're speaking, Robert, I'm thinking of those interactions that, well, that we all have like that. Like my husband, you know, isn't it kind of silly that like every morning you wake up and it's always the same conversation with the person who's sleeping next to you, which is like, how'd you sleep? Oh, well, I, you know, and yet, yeah, like you say, it's not. It is that we're trying to connect and relate, but we're doing it in not a great way. So, okay, Robert, so I slept 8.5 hours last night. What can you say as a radical listener that's going to be better than telling me about your 9 hours?
Well, one counterintuitive approach to listening is asking questions. And I say counterintuitive because asking questions is actually speaking rather than just listening. And what a question does is it invites you to talk more, which invites the opportunity for more connection. So I could ask a follow-up, like, how does it feel? Obviously, your husband's going to know the amount of sleep you need. But if it's someone who knows you less well, and you say 8.5 hours, I might say, well, how typical is that? Was it a good 8.5 hours? You know, something that invites you just to expand on your experience. And those questions demonstrate real interest in the speaker and the topic.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation about radical listening. It's the art of true connection with our guests who have really complicated last names, but Christian Van Nieuwenberg and Robert Biswas Diener. And they have co-written this book that's really interesting. And I have to say, Christian, I'll point this one to you, that Mary Beth and I were talking before the interview. And I was saying, it seems to me that there are two kinds of listening that I think of. It's the one where you're trying not to be distracted by other things. And the other one is that you're trying hard to listen to someone who's saying something that you really vehemently disagree with. And you do talk a lot about polarization in your book. But Christian, can you just expand on that, those challenges, I guess?
Thank you so much, Lynn and Mary Beth. And by the way, you are both examples of radical listeners. So I just wanted to highlight that. I guess to interview people, you need to be able to do that. And one of the secrets, of course, is we say not only looking interested, but being interested. So that's probably one of the secrets of radical listening, is finding ways to be interested in your conversational partner. Now, that relates to the second question about polarization. One of the barriers to listening is to believe that you're right. So if I'm getting into a conversation and I believe that I'm 100% right and the other person is 100% wrong, then it's logical that I'm not listening because I'm thinking I've got nothing to learn here. So I would say with the polarization one, what we're advocating for is using listening as a way of building that initial connection. And we would say we use radical listening to not necessarily to agree. In fact, that's not the point of radical listening. Radical listening is to show that you're interested in the other person. So even if it's a polar opposite view, I'd say the curiosity we're trying to bring is, I wonder how this person has come to the view that they have. And by just showing that sincere curiosity and openness to hearing it without all the internal barriers of they're wrong, I disagree with it. So it's the ability to put those things aside. And my hope is that if I initiate that by genuinely being interested and respectful of them, and they're right to have that opinion. That's the really fundamental thing here, is they have a right to have that opinion. And my curiosity is, I wonder how they came to that. Now, the hope is that if I do that for them and I show genuine interest and openness to their ideas without having to agree with them, my hope is they're going to be a little bit more open to, hey, how come, Christian, you've come to that opposing view? And that's the basis, really, for dialogue, isn't it? And on the other point, Lynn, about distractedness, yeah, everything's distracting us now. We've got things buzzing on our phones, on our watches. So it really makes radical listening even more powerful, because the simple act, this is for any of the listeners out there, you can start doing it now. And that is the radical act, is to say, I'm going to invest time to listen to you. That's what I'm going to do. And in the busy world we're in, that can feel so powerful. But there's two aspects to distractions. There's all the external distractions that are going on. We all know what those are. But it's also trying to minimize internal distractions. And that's by becoming aware of our own self-talk, what's kind of going on in our heads, and what do I need as the listener so that I can give my full attention to other people. So for example, if I've had a really bad day in the office and I'm just going home to be with my family, maybe I'll take a little walk around the park just before I get back into my house. You know, it's trying to create that little buffer so that I've got the attention I need so that I can bring it with me into that interaction.
I heard years ago about a story where a man decided on his way home from work each day, instead of just listening to the news on the radio, he was going to turn off the sounds and just think of three things he was really thankful for about his family, and how it put him in such a different state of mind coming through the door than if he was just still full of all that stimulation and all those outside distractions. It sounds like what you're saying, Kristen, is at the base of a lot of radical listening is respect. It's respect for the other person, maybe self-respect too, that you don't feel you have to jump in with a whole bunch of self-esteem boosting techniques. Tell us more of what that might entail.
Mary Beth, thank you for saying that word, respect. You've really, this is another example of radical listening. I don't think we've used that word, but for you to pick that up, that is an example of radical listening. It's kind of noticing what's kind of behind all of this. And yes, absolutely. And you know, one thing about my own personal background is my mother was Japanese, the person who raised me, she was Japanese. And I think the idea of respect was really powerfully taught to me from her and her culture. And you know, it's really interesting because working with Robert on this book, my understanding of respect is that you never interrupt somebody else when they're talking. And that was really, you know, taught to me. But in our radical listening book, we actually argue that we should interject. We call it interjection because I just couldn't bring myself to say interrupt someone. But what we mean by interjection is to show that we're so committed to what the other person is saying that we want to jump in with, oh, wow, that's really interesting. So these are little interjections that are about encouraging the person to say more. It's building their confidence in what they're saying. So I guess the idea of radical listening is that, first of all, you're listening to somebody in a way that's highly respectful of them. And this includes what we were saying about polarized situations where I don't have to agree with your view, but I definitely respect your right as a human being to have views that are different to mine. And the best way to demonstrate that is to give them an opportunity to explain that in a respectful way. So yeah, I definitely think radical listening is a way of listening to people that makes them feel valued.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the book, you guys go into the difference between internal listening skills and external listening skills. Robert, maybe you want to address the difference between those things and what they mean for how we can more radically listen to each other.
Yeah, so we like to think of radical listening as a set of skills. This means that we can all learn it and that you don't have to take some expensive training or go to college for it. They're all pretty natural. So the listening skills include things just like quieting your own inner chatter, just kind of creating a mental or internal quiet. Also noticing a conversation really as a unit of interaction is just a whole bunch of noticing and then deciding what to do with what you're noticing. So you, for example, just noticed that respect seemed to be a theme, and then you decided to comment on it by asking a question. That's perfect radical listening. So you have to be paying enough attention just to notice what are the themes, what's the emotional tone of the person I'm talking about, how much agreement or consensus is there among the group about what's being discussed. You're just noticing, noticing, noticing. And when you notice something that seems important or powerful, that's when you shift to the external skills, things like acknowledging it, just calling it out. Here's something I see. Here's something I support. Here's something I'm inspired by. Or questioning it. Tell me more about that. I don't understand what you mean. Or that's very different than how I think. I'm curious how you came to that conclusion. Or at the most extreme version, the interjecting, which is another behavioral skill, which is just popping in with a wow, or can I cut you off right there? Because that sounds important, those types of things. So the behavioral skills are the things that you would see, and the internal skills are invisible. They're happening within you, but still equally as important.
Robert, it's bringing up for me this question about, well, it has to do with the difference between interrupting and interjecting, I think. I have someone very dear to me with whom, when I speak, there's a lot of, this person is an admitted ADD, like really struggles with it, and there's constant interrupting and a lot of times it doesn't feel very respectful. And yet if it was more like an interjection, then we could transform the dialogue a little bit. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, because I think we will all interrupt when we just want to get on with it. You know, we just want to get on with the conversation and maybe someone's droning on too long. And so we all have this struggle.
Absolutely. It's very common. So here's a quick masterclass on how to interrupt. Interruption is just overlapping speech, just two people talking simultaneously. So even when you say, you're speaking simultaneously, that is technically an interruption, but mostly it's not perceived as an interruption. The things we perceive as interruptions is when you take the person's turn to talk away from them. And that's what's considered rude. But if you say something quickly, and then return the turn to speak to them, it's almost never even perceived as an interruption at all, even though that's exactly what it is. So if you say, guess what? And I insert a little joke, and then I shut up and allow you to tell me what? You think that's just engaged conversation. Or if I say, oh, wow, while you're talking, and I say that right over you, you still have the turn to talk, and you think that's just fine. Even if I say, let me stop you right there, that's amazing. Tell me more about that. That's a clear interruption, but you think that it's very respectful. So the goal is to interrupt with the motive of showing engagement and very quickly returning the turn to speak to the person who is speaking.
I like that. Thank you. Christian, I have to ask about this thing that we do. And, you know, this maybe is not in a workplace, although it could be. Sometimes when I'm at home and it's just my husband and I at home together, I am thinking aloud in words that are, you know, I might as well just be saying them to myself in my head. But it's this little dialogue that happens between people. In order to expect someone to be a radical listener to us, what is our job as the person speaking and delivering that?
What a great question, Lynn. You know, everything that we talk about in radical listening, I think applies in workplaces, but also in our homes. So what you're asking is a wonderful question. From the radical listening point of view, we talk a lot about intention. Right. So making sure that we go into an interaction with a clear intention. Do I want to learn something? Do I want to solve something? Do I want to value somebody? So I think what the person listened to can do to be helpful is to be clear what's wanted. So sometimes, for example, I will actually get in touch with Robert. Robert's not only my co-author, he's a good friend of mine. And sometimes I'll get in touch with him and say, look, Robert, I just really need to vent about something. I've just had this experience. I'm almost giving him a clue about what's wanted. In other words, I don't actually want Robert to solve it for me. Well, in other situations, I might say, Robert, I'm kind of stuck with something. I'm desperate for ideas. So by doing that, it leads to what we talk about in the book as optimal support matching. And that's when what the person who's being listened to wants and what the listener is doing are perfectly aligned. So if the listener just wants a chance to say, no, the person being listened to just wants a chance to be acknowledged. Sometimes that's all we want. I might be going through a really difficult patch at work, and all I need is somebody to say, gosh, Christian, you know, that's sounding pretty tough. How are you coping? That's all I need. But if there's a mismatch, I guess all the listeners who are listening now will know exactly what I'm saying. When I just need to be heard, and the other person just can't wait to give me advice, or, oh, you know, if I were in your shoes, that mismatch can ironically lead to disconnection or some kind of frustration, whereas matching. And that's why the skill of noticing that Robert mentioned is so important. So even if the person you're listening to you doesn't give you the clues, I think a radical listener will be trying to pick that up. What is this person wanting from me? And then if we can match that, that's what leads to what we call the art of true connection.
I love that. We have a thing in our household that if someone's upset, we try to remember to ask them if they want to be hugged, heard, or helped. Because a lot of times you do have a very clear understanding of what you need, but maybe you just want a vent, like you mentioned, and then somebody wants to fix the situation, to swoop in, and it's so frustrating. Even if you maybe want it fixed, you just don't want it fixed right at that minute. And it's a fascinating thing, our various kind of human needs, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, I have a question for you. I've had a few folks in my life, as I imagine we all have, who are just talkers, who almost eliminate the little breaks, the natural breaks that would designate that it's time allowing the other person to speak. And it's so exhausting that I end up being kind of avoidant. Do you have any tips for helping cultivate a healthy dialogue with people who are quite verbose?
Well, it can be really difficult, what you're saying, especially because the people sometimes are impassioned. And so they kind of bowl you over. There's an emotional tone to what they're saying. Sometimes they're maybe not socially gifted in a way that recognizes who's participating or sort of the lopsided balance of participation in the conversation. And so there's no real map for us conversationally about how to jump in. One thing is when I interject, and this is going to be another interjection, I often try and do it with permission. So, hey, do you mind if I interrupt you? Or do you mind if I jump in there? And typically when you interject, it's an easier pill for the person to swallow if you provide an explanation of why you're doing it. So it's not, do you mind if I jump in because you're talking entirely too much and I'm bored? But rather, do you mind if I jump in because I'm curious about X? Now, if you do ask a question, you can imagine that you might get another onslaught of information, but which is possible, but at least you've sort of steered the conversation or you've participated in the conversation. Or you might say, do you mind if I jump in? That reminds me of a very similar thing that happened to me, where you're trying to just gently insert an opportunity for yourself in the conversation. Typically with the, do you mind if I jump in and here's why I'm doing it, is easier for people to accept than just blurting something out or taking their turn to speak.
Well, that makes sense. I will try that. I gotta say, I'm not sure it will work with some of these people. They are very talented avoiders of social contracts, but we will try. You mentioned in the part two, the internal listening skills about quieting yourself down. And sometimes I feel like if I interject more than is ideal, it's because I'm worried I'm going to forget what I wanted to say, or the conversation is going to move on and I won't have been able to say that really interesting thing or that really important question. How can we just let ourselves learn to go with the flow? You know, so what if you forget it? Just let it unfold.
Yeah, I like that question, Mary Beth. And, you know, we want to be inclusive of everyone who we're talking to. And I think you mentioned the word social contracting, a phrase social contracting just a moment ago. And I do think that's an interesting idea. Even in that previous example you gave, just some kind of agreement to say, you know, when things pop into my mind, is it okay if I just chuck them in? It's because I don't want to forget them. The other idea is maybe to interject, as we've said, and say, can we come back to this later? Because that would be a way to say, I want to say something about this, but it's your turn to talk. And Mary Beth, I do this, and Robert might acknowledge that this happens sometimes. Sometimes I just can't wait. So I just jump in and say, you've reminded me of something I'd like to say, but carry on. And that kind of is a little marker that there's something I'd like to do. So I think it comes back to this idea of if we agree to turn taking, really not to take the other person's turn, but to make sure the conversation feels inclusive for everyone. And the other thing to say is that radical listening, we see it as the entry point to real dialogue. So there are opportunities once we've built that connection to have a dialogue which is more free flowing. I'll say a few things, you'll say a few things. I also like setting up a conversation, which is saying, agreeing, how should we have this conversation? I also like, you know, that idea, one of my professional roles is an executive coach, and that means I sit and I listen to people a lot of the time. And sometimes when I'm going to a coffee shop with my friends, I fall back into that just listening thing. And then I remember, wait a minute, I've got things to say as well. So there have been times when I say, hey, I've got a lot of new ideas I want to share with everyone, just to make sure I'm noting I'm not going to be that quiet one. So yeah, a few ideas like that. But the idea of radical listening is really to be as inclusive as possible and really try and pick up what is my conversational partner's, what are their needs, and how can we meet those needs?
Wow, it's like communicating about communicating. Yeah. If we kind of are very conscious about the process, we will all be so much more satisfied. Well, the book is called Radical Listening, The Art of True Connection. And we've been talking with Professor Christian van Nieuwenberg and Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener. Thank you so much for talking about this. This is a wonderful book. I think it's a book that not only will give us great skills, but also spark really interesting discussions. Thank you so much for being with us on The Mountain Life.
Thanks. It was great being listened to by you.
Thanks so much.
Love it. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
SkiMo, or ski mountaineering racing, is a human-powered endurance competition that involves climbing mountains on skis and or by foot, and in many race disciplines, passing through a series of transitions before descending on skis. If it sounds simple, it's anything but, as our next guests will attest. There are three Park City locals who have recently competed in the World Championships in Switzerland. Two of these guests returned home to take a breather before heading back to Europe. They are 16-year-old Sam Kirshner and 17-year-old Josh Itoy. We're also speaking with 19-year-old Griffin Briley, who stayed in Europe to compete even after winning world championship titles. Griffin joins us from Val Martello, Italy. And Sam and Josh, I'm assuming you're joining us from Park City. Welcome to all of you. We're really happy to have you. I've wanted to talk to all of you SkiMo animals for a long time. Griffin, since you're the one, because you're the oldest, I'm assuming that you got into it before Josh and Sam did. So let's start with you. You basically are racing back to back to back and not even coming back to Park City. Can you give us an overview of your sort of travel schedule and all the wonderful places you get to go to compete?
Yeah, sure. So actually, I'm not sure that I started SkiMo before Josh and his brother, but fortunately, they kind of inspired me to really get into it, and they were super welcoming when I was getting into the sport. I think I was around the age of 13 or 14 when I first got into it, and ever since, I've just been really passionate about the sport and the places it takes me. Right now, the travel and race schedule is really busy. Just driving from race to race across Europe has been such a great experience, especially with Team USA. We're just this contingent that's really growing in the sport, given that, I don't know, the other European countries have been dominant for a long time. We're starting to make a statement and also trying to get our Olympic quota spot for next year. So yeah, it's been really cool. We just went to Morzine, Switzerland, where we had the World Championships, and then followed by the World Cup in Schladming, Austria, where they also have a famous downhill World Cup. And then now I'm in Valmartello for the second to last mixed relay of the season. So it's going to be a super, super important week for Team USA.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Well, let's talk a little bit about SkiMo in general. I think people know it as ski mountaineering. You know, there's a big contingent of people who line up very early in the morning to do some uphill exercise at Park City Mountain. But it's an insane sport. First of all, you're on this equipment that's really light, and then you have to race downhill on it. Can you just go over the components of it and, gosh, why you like it?
Yeah, for me, SkiMo is truly an expression of freedom on the slopes. You can go anywhere. You can really push yourself physically and mentally. And that's something that I really enjoy about it. Just that aspect. But at its truest, SkiMo is just going up and down with skins on your skis, taking them off the top and skiing down as quick as you can. I feel like there's many ways you can put it. There's not really a wrong answer, but it's backcountry ski touring, but racing.
And it's pretty vigorous, right? Anyone that I know who's into SkiMo seems like they're in pretty great shape. Is it physically as demanding as it sounds?
Yeah, I could agree, but after some time, that seems like less of the, I guess, challenge. Maybe I just like love it to the point where it doesn't really hurt. Who knows? Sure.
Josh, I have a question for you. So if you've been in it quite a while, like how many years do you think it's been starting to be visible in the United States? I know it's a bit more popular in Europe, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, when I started, the first race I did was on my 8th birthday. So that was 8 or 9 years ago now. It was definitely very small then, you know, you're on like heavy skis. I'd say I've started racing more seriously in the last probably 3 years or so. And that's around when I kind of started noticing some of my friends were talking about going to Europe and racing. So I kind of think around then it was starting to expand a lot, and the youth community has grown a lot, especially in Utah and in Park City. It's really grown a lot.
So what do you attribute that to, Josh? Because it seems like I remember once, it was a long time ago, but there was a SkiMo competitor, Gemma, who came. She was a dual immersion teacher, and she was also a World Cup SkiMo competitor. And I think she and some other people who have been on the World Cup happened to live in Park City, and they got it going. You know, where do you train, and how has it grown so much? Like, what's the coaching support there?
Yeah, I mean, I personally train just right at the Park City Mountain a lot, you know, early in the morning or kind of at night. There's a lot of options where people go. I know a lot of people like to train in the backcountry. But yeah, it's definitely the community, I think, has grown a lot, especially with kids. A lot of kids come from mountain biking and they like to do this in the off season. And then they find that they like this sport and want to be more committed to it.
Yeah, let's bring Sam in. Sam Kirshner, I'm wondering what kind of competitive athletes make the best SkiMo competitors? Are they runners? Are they like just as mountain bikers?
It really varies. People like Cam Smith on the U.S. team, he is a pro ultra runner. And John Gaston is a professional cyclist. So whatever works best for training or whatever you like to do in the summer seems to be working.
You know, we're focusing on you all because you're young. And as Josh said, that this organization is growing like crazy. It's funny, my kids, you know, they always say, why would you do something like this when you can ride the lift up and have the gravity pull you down? But there's something that's going on, this movement within the youth in Park City. You know, we heard a little bit from Griffin why he likes it. Sam, why are you addicted to it?
I just like training hard. I mean, I like the work that I put into it, and being outside in the cold and training in beautiful mountains, which is where it all is just an amazing experience. So it's just bliss being able to race and work for this sport.
Oh, that's wonderful. How is it different, Sam, you can carry on, from training for this versus training on a traditional like Park City ski team?
I mean, not much different. Obviously, I get to venture to the backcountry and go explore like mountaintops and all that, which is cool, but not too different, I don't think.
And is this something that colleges have teams now, or is it still mostly kind of communities that are putting teams together?
It's still mostly community. I've heard of it's like Western Colorado University that has a SkiMo team, and they fund their athletes and support them. So hopefully it'll be on the rise.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about results. You guys all went to world championships in Switzerland. So Griffin, yeah. You were on top of the podium in a couple different disciplines, and congratulations. How did it all go?
Yeah. First of all, thank you. It was a super long week packed with like 5 races in a row for some athletes. Starting on the first day, we had the mixed relay, and my partner was McCall Birkinshaw, and we had a pretty rough start. We had some challenges during the qualification round, which is how you get seeded into your final round, but we made it. And then we came in third for the mixed relay. We just like had to channel like all resilience capacities and just push it to the line. I've never finished more tired and fulfilled in my life. I just like collapsed over the finish line. Because physically it's hard, but also mentally you do 2 laps and you have to collect yourself in between those laps. And usually there can be 7 to 10 minutes to prepare all your gear, fuel up, and then get to the handoff zone where, I don't know, it's can be pretty chaotic. So that was super cool to share that experience with McCall. And then day after, I think we had the vertical and I was completely wiped from the day before. So I had to really give it my all and race smart. And in the end, I came out on top. So that was a super cool day. We'll never forget. And then we had a rest day on Wednesday. And then the sprint was on Thursday. And I just sneaked my way through the rounds. And then in the final lap, so the final sprint heat, I started in the back because I was just like super tired from all the racing I had in my legs and that day before. And I came into the final transition in fourth, and so the, like the transition zone is where you take your skis off of your skins or take your skins off of your skis and ski downhill. And I came into it fourth and left first, and I don't know how that happened. I guess I just raced smart. And
that's amazing. Okay, well, this leads me into a question that I've wanted to ask, because the thing that keeps me from really loving backcountry skiing is taking my skins off and or putting them back on. And yet you guys do it in about, 3 seconds? Talk a little bit about that, that's such a big part. You came in fourth, you left first. How much time is that to take off your skins and throw them wherever you throw them?
Yeah. So nowadays the equipment is so advanced in terms of speed. So the quickest you can take your skins off is around 4 to 5 seconds. And you just... you lock your boots into ski mode, you flip your heels, and then you grab the skin tips and you just rip them off both. You jump and you rip them off both at the same time. And then you roll them into a ball and stuff them in this pouch across your suit. I call it a kangaroo pouch. A lot of them are homemade. So I'm sure the Josh and Sam can do it a lot quicker, but.
Well, maybe there's an opportunity for you with the kangaroo pouch. If ski mode really blows up, you can have your first product line.
Oh, yeah. I think I should have caught on to that at the beginning of this season because all of the big brands have started doing it now. So too late to that game.
Well, I got a question for Josh. So just now Griffin mentioned like the vertical. I'm not familiar with the different elements. Like, is there a vertical day and a distance day or how is it set up?
So there's 4 disciplines of race. The vertical is just one uphill. It's usually like 1700 vertical feet, and you just are going, it's just one climb and you finish at the top. Kind of the original, I guess, race discipline was the individual. So that's the longest race. It's anywhere from like an hour to an hour and a half. And that can be anywhere like 3 to 6 climbs at the world championships. So that you have a lot of different uphills. You have boot pack sections where you put your skis on your back and hike or run. and downhills. And then my kind of personal favorite discipline is the sprint. So that's a very short race, usually around 3 minutes, that you have a climb, you have a short boot pack running section, another short skinning section, and then you have a downhill through gates to the finish.
Gosh, that sounds so intense. And is there specialized equipment, or are you able to kind of cobble together a Ski-Mo kit from things you might have in your gearbox already?
Like for the different disciplines, you mean?
Yeah.
I personally only have one setup that I race. A lot of people, though, will have lighter skis for the vertical specifically, and there are different skins for the sprint. There's some specific stuff, but in general, most of the gear can be used for all the disciplines.
I guess the one thing that caught me is when you said running, and I'm just trying to imagine what kind of boots you're able to run in. Is it kind of like a telly boot or?
Yeah, it's similar. So the boot pivots very easily from the upper section to the actual kind of shoe part. So on Ski-Mo boots, you unlock them in walk mode and you have a much more range of motion. And then when you get to the top, you relock your boots and it kind of turns into a more rigid downhill ski boot.
If you're just joining us, that is Josh Itoy, along with Griffin Briley and Sam Kirshner. They are Ski-Mo athletes who just returned from age group world championships in Switzerland. Sam, we need to get a little bit more into the nitty-gritty of this crazy sport. So what are the weights of your boots and your skis and then your pack?
I think my skis in total are like 2 kilograms and my boots probably around the same. So about a pound or two on each foot. And then my pack on sprint day, I just put a puffy jacket in it. So it's around 100 grams. And on individual day, probably 5 pounds with all of my avalanche gear.
Wow. Oh, yes, the avalanche gear. And that's, I mean, what are you required to carry? I would imagine probe, shovel, beacon,
yeah,
and
beacon.
Are these specialized yeah. Ski-Mo types?
They do make lightweight ones. Griffin, are you allowed to have plastic shovels?
Yeah. So the gear for the individual races is probably the most complex list of them all. We have compulsory equipment that we need to carry for each individual race. So starting with the basics, your backpack that has a ski carry system. So for the boot pack section, you carry your beacon, shovel, and your probe. And then on top of that, you carry a space blanket, a whistle, identification card, and 2 other layers. So that's usually a wind layer or a puffy layer in some conditions.
It sounds pretty intense. Sam, do you wear a heart rate monitor? And if so, what does your heart rate get up to?
I don't wear a heart rate monitor racing, but training, I get up to like 190 to 195 going full tilt.
That's pretty high. That's great. And, you know, it really seems like with what you all are explaining that you go to these competitions and it's day after day after day. And so recovery must be a huge component. And it makes me think that while Griffin said he was totally wiped out from the previous day, he must have recovered enough to, you know, be atop the podium. So, Sam, what does your recovery look like, your regime?
It's really just about eating a lot of food and a lot of water. So lots of carbs, lots of protein. Sleeping well, getting at least 8 hours is very important. Sometimes I like to put my legs up on a wall for 10 to 15 minutes and that helps the blood drain out of there and clear lactic acid.
Right.
How can somebody watch? Like, are there spectators at the Ski-Mo events or are they televised or anything yet? Or is this something that we just should be lobbying our media companies for?
There are spectators at the events. European communities like to show up for them, which is very nice. And the Olympic Channel has started broadcasting some events, mostly just mixed relay and sprint.
Ah.
I'm not sure if vertical and individual are televised too often.
Sure. And how does that work? Griffin had mentioned this, the mixed relay too. How does it work when you have an event that has a partner?
So there's a box where when you finish your lap, you tag your partner within the box. So when the person's done with their lap, they tag you, you go out for your lap and tag
them. Okay, so it's like a relay kind of.
So you have a pre-matched partner before the mixed relay. So that's your team. You each do your one qualification lap of the relay course, and then you get seeded into an A final or a B final, or you don't get seeded at all, depending on how quick your combined time was. And then after that, the female starts the first lap and then tags off to the male partner. And then you repeat that two times, and each relay loop has two uphills and two downhills and one boot pack. So it can get pretty complex pretty quick.
That sounds pretty complex. Josh, let's go to you. You know, I'm wondering about the vertical feat that you're climbing in a, you know, in the different types of races. And then also, what would be the longest period of time that you would be out on a course?
Yeah, so in terms of vertical feat, the longest would be the individual. So that, I think at Worlds, it was around 3,400 vertical feet. Then that would be a pretty long course. And that's, I believe we were out on course around an hour, 20 minutes or so, or hour and a half. So that's about the longest you'd be out there. For a vertical race, then that's around usually 1,700 feet or so. And that takes, I think, usually around half an hour. And then for a sprint, it's no more than a couple hundred.
Wow. Okay. Oh, you guys must be so fit. Okay. I just have to go to the Milan Cortina Olympics, which are taking place next year, 2026. What is the status of Skimo? It's not it's not like a pilot or an exhibition sport. It's actually really taking place in the Olympics. And I don't know who can talk to this best, but Josh, if you can, go ahead.
I think I'm probably not the best one to answer that.
Okay, Griffin, I know you're being on the World Cup. You probably know a lot about this.
So Skimo will make its true Olympic debut in 2026 at the Milano Cortina Games. The event will be hosted in Bormio, Italy. So just over the hill from where I am now. I'm not too sure how many countries go. I don't know. I don't know the nitty gritty, but that's kind of the bottom line, that it will be in the Olympics.
And so you being a 19-year-old competitor, I know you also compete with the elite on the World Cup. Is this something that you're hopeful for, or is it, I think you mentioned Cam Smith and I've heard of him before, and is there a chance that we'll see you in the Olympics this go around, or are we going to have to wait to see all of you compete here in Salt Lake City and Park City for the 2034 Olympics?
Yeah, for sure. I think the Olympics are on a lot of people's minds. And at the moment, it is too for a lot of people on the U.S. team, including Cam Smith and I. And it's unsure whether or not either of us will go due to the fact that we're still in the process of securing our quota spot for next year. And so right now, the focus is 110% on earning our spot in the mixed relay.
So if people are listening and they are thinking to themselves, wow, this sounds really interesting, I want to check out Skimo. Do you have any recommendations for ways that they can explore the sport or start to get involved with it?
Renting equipment and starting at Park City Mountain Resort is definitely a good starting point. There's I think it's Offset Brewery has a skinning club Thursday night, which is a great spot to have some support from other community members on getting started.
Perfect. And then as far as you know, can you take Skimo lessons or maybe just ask around at Offset Brewing or at the ski rental places?
I think Park City Skimo also has a master's program for people outside of the youth program. So that is a good starting point too.
Does that all operate out of the Utah Olympic Park, Sam?
Park City Skimo has practices all over the place in Park City. So Park City Mountain Resort, Guardsmen sometimes, and obviously lots of UOP.
I know that there is a shop called something like Utah Skimo in Salt Lake City. But other than that, the specific gear for Skimo, I mean, a lot of people show up on their old Tele skis or their AT gear, which is very heavy. Is this starting to be more mainstream, Sam? In your world it is, but for the rest of us.
Yeah, definitely becoming more mainstream. It's a good way to get exercise in for many people. So having lighter equipment and being able to do it easier is definitely on the rise.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, before we let you go, and we're probably about out of time here, I want to make sure that I mention, because we heard from Griffin, what he did at World Championships. Sam and Josh, I'd love to hear from you, because I know you had some good results, but I'm not sure what they are. So, Sam, what were your results at World Championships that you're excited about?
I'm really excited about my individual day. I kind of got all the nerves together from World Championships and was able to just put down a good race. I ended up getting 16th, and as the first year, I'm excited for what that means for my second year as a U18.
That's great. And Josh, let's hear about yours.
My best race was the sprint. I came in 17th for the qualifier.
Great. Well, congratulations. I mean, to go to any World Championships is really, really exciting. Okay, Griffin Briley, Josh Itoy, and Sam Kirshner, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today. I think this sport, I just could go on asking you questions about this all day, and I'm even fairly familiar with it. It's so complex, and I just love that you as young people are doing this and getting out there and, you know, just doing something that's so intense and so good for your lungs and your body. So thank you all so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Thanks to you all.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
And again, that was Josh Itoy, Sam Kirshner, and Griffin Briley. And just a note, we pre-recorded that interview last week. Since then, Griffin Briley has competed in another World Cup in Italy, had a great finish, and it'll be fun to watch these three athletes as they further their Skimo careers. And hopefully they'll inspire a few of us to do a little Skimo, a little uphill travel. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.